ask you to introduce a computational algorithm for finding unitary gates given a set of control Hamiltonians and some drift that is a static or time constant piece in your Hamiltonian? And I will first motivate it a little bit, although you may have been exposed to a bit of motivation over the weekend already, because you may have found out that it's a bit of a nightmare trying to figure out how to control your quantum system if you only have to do it by hand. So today we're going to look at one algorithm for finding control. So for quantum computing, I'm gonna just put down what are we generally after, and I say quantum computing because for other tasks like simulations or some spectroscopy applications, it may not necessarily be true. But for quantum computing, we generally are after a set of unitary operators or gates. And we're typically given a set of classical fields or controls in almost all applications. These are some form of electromagnetic fields that you then manipulate externally. So here I just call it a set, CIT. They're all real valued. And there's a set of corresponding Hamiltonians. So, for a physical system, just like for the homework, you start with these control fields and you start with these Hamiltonians, and you've got some target gates that you want to find to do your universal computation. So the question is how to find suitable control sequences. And you also want your gates to be robust. What I mean by that is they should be resilient to noise, given a particular noise model that varies from system to system, as we've seen. You almost always want your gates to be as short as possible, given that they satisfy the robustness still. Since if we stretch out our gates, we leave more time for unwanted effects to happen in our system. So we would like them to be short. And we want to minimize the energy deposited in our system. So as I said, typically we use electromagnetic fields. And of course, electric and magnetic fields have got an associated energy. Also, your circuits aren't perfectly conducting. So, every time you turn your fields on and off, you will be heating up your system, which in general, it's not something you want to happen. There's more that I could add here, but this is just to give you the idea of task. And now I'm going to say, why are you might we prefer computational or algorithmic finding of these controls? So of course, as David mentioned in the lecture, when you turn to algorithmic control finding, you give up a little bit of insight, because typically from the algorithm, you get an output which looks like some like random mess. Especially since you impose so many conditions or so many constraints on your solution that it may not be something that's got intuitive sort of understanding. But there's still reasons why you might want to do it computationally. I'm going to list a few here. Now, the first and foremost that I've put down here is typically you're dealing with something which is not a single qubit. So your nice geometric picture, the SO3, SU2 equivalent will not hold. And it becomes a lot harder to reason what would be the control sequences that work. So bigger Hilbert spaces, or larger. Now, sometimes you've got very strange constraints on your controls. They may be asymmetric. Some controls may be dependent on one another, so that makes it harder for pen and paper approach to succeed. Some control settings. You may also, in your homeworks, you assume that you can instantly turn on and off your controls. That may not be true. In fact, as David also mentioned, sometimes because of our classical electronics, we've got finite rise times, finite decay times for our controls. So if we're looking to do things with really high fidelity, we need to take that into account. But we do give up some intuition. But I'm saying here that intuitive solutions are not always optimal. And this refers back to the point over there that typically you do want your gates to be as short as possible. So I guess I mean time optimal here. The algorithm I'm going to present is called GRAPE. It's an acronym. It stands for Gradient Descent Pulse Engineering. You can tell that they tried hard to get an acronym that reads out as a word, but the paper is from 2005. JMR stands for Journal of Magnetic Resonance. I'm not sure if you guys have ever looked into that journal, but... Okay, so let's see. So to begin with, we need some kind of model. And I'm going to start off with just putting down Hamiltonian for my system, which consists of the drift part, which is time independent. And I've got the set of, you know, called capital M classical controls that control the strength of these Hamiltonian terms, HI. I might say that they drift. Now, I take them to act on a Hilbert space of any size. So I'm just going to say that it's dimension D. To keep it as generic as possible. Of course, I've already eliminated some possibilities here, like interdependent controls. Now, this sum of control fields is nice and affine, which may not be the case. But actually, once we're done, you will see that even if it wasn't the case, the same analysis would apply. You would have to add an extra derivative, but that's really that. Permission operators. On D-dimensional Hilbert space. And CI, as I said, are some time-dependent real control field. I lost my page too. So now the task is what I described before. We pick some time capital T. And we say that at time capital T, we want the unitary, which is generated by this Hamiltonian H of T, time going from 0 to capital T. The unitary has to hit some value, which we call V target. T is greater than 0. V target is a desired. Now this is not working out. Target unitary or gate. And we also know that we probably should respect the Schrodinger's equation. So U of T at any given time, its derivative is given by the Hamiltonian multiplying unitary at that time. This crowd will probably not get too upset if I drop the H bar. And U at time 0 is the identity. And on top of that, we want the control fields, the CIs, to satisfy all constraint that we impose on them. So these could be some maximum and minimum values. These could be some some maximum rate changes so that you can't change it instantaneously between different values. If you're imposing energy deposition constraints, then you would have to integrate the squared values and put bounds on that. Oh, and here I've written down, but I'm probably not going to write it on the board, that this is an example of a bilinear control problem. I only wrote it down because there's a lot of results that are known to control theorists and that have been published in the Journal of Differential Equations, only to be re-derived in less generality 20 years later. So it's worthwhile to know, I don't pretend that I know anything about control theory. But that particular setting that you've got a set of generating matrices is called a bilinear control problem. So, so it's the appearance of the generator that generates the propagator, the U of T. Now, bilinear control theory problems are so that any problem for which you generate some kind of propagator from a set of matrices like that. So these need not be Hermitian; they can be anything. And the same algorithm would work perfectly for non-Hermitian matrices as well. So in fact, you can use it to design control for non-unitary dynamics as well. Did Joe tell you about dissipators? So it would apply. So our approach will be to assume that we've got piecewise control. So this makes life a lot easier computationally. Piecewise constant control. And also, usually our electronics permits was this type of control. So what we do is we take our timeline 0 to t and we split it up into intervals, which need not, I won't make them equal to each other to keep it more general, but in the example that I'm going to show you, or in fact, any time I've ever searched for control, I've always used the equal intervals. That's the window here. I'm gonna change the notation for my CIs a little bit. So I'm going to denote that CI at time t during some interval, tj minus 1 to tj, is given just by the index j hanging around in the brackets. And in such case, we know that the final propagator is easy to evaluate. It's just the product of n matrix exponentials. I should have said before about the model that I didn't include noise term, which we've emphasized many times is important. But as you will see later, it would only introduce an extra index, which I thought maybe it's easier to go to the analysis without keeping track of that index. And then just say how you would deal with it later. Okay, so now we need some sort of metric for how, what's going on here? How close is U of T to the target unit array that we wish to implement? So I've just picked, you can pick your favorite distance measure for matrices. I should. Thanks. So I just pick something which I call fidelity. Denote it by phi, and I define it as 1/d², which was the Hilbert space dimension. And it's going to be Hilbert Schmidt inner product. And I may or may not choose to take the square root of it. It doesn't really change anything. And you can easily see that this thing is always positive. In fact, it's it's always smaller or equal to 1. It's equal to 1 if we've managed to create our target unitary. It's always greater or equal to 0. And you will also notice that as well as being a function of, well, capital T is a function of all of our control fields. So I can also write that this guy is a function of the set of control fields that I have, of which there are capital M times capital N values. So now all we need to do is maximize this guy computationally. So in principle, you could pick your favorite optimization algorithm, give it some initial values, and let it run. But does help immensely if you know the derivatives. And of course, you could do finer differences on it, not evaluate derivatives analytically, but you will see that as n and m grow, this would start to give you a lot of work. So actually the entire contribution of this paper, a gradient descent existed before 2005. And all they do is they basically introduce a clever way of evaluating derivatives with respect to CIJ. So that's what we're going to do now. We're going to look at, so the partial derivatives. For some reason, we use this delta here. Even though it's not necessarily a functional derivative. So what I've done here is, you see that Phi of CIJ, in its definition, retarget doesn't depend on CIJ, it's only the UT. And I can combine the two terms to give me a real part of this object, which is computationally nicer to treat because it saves us half the work. So all we need to find, so we don't have to bother with finding the derivatives of u dagger. All we need to find are these derivatives. And we're going to do that. Now we notice that all exponentials, matrix exponentials, they're in the definition of UT. All but one are independent of CKJ. So as we differentiate, we will only need to differentiate one matrix exponential. I was trying to come up with clever ways of how to define my quantity so that I wouldn't have to write so much on the board. And not with too much success, I Yeah. Would be good if I could have dropped the drift Hamiltonian at least. So this part, which is independent of CKJ, I will call this product of N minus J operators. This gets cluttered here, doesn't it? Now I've got this derivative of a matrix exponential. So does anyone have any recommendations how to do that? I remember back in the day, I think we used the identity that I'm going to employ in a second in our field theory class, but you'll see. Maybe you'll recognize. And then I've got another J matrix exponentials that are multiplying together. No, J minus one actually. So I will write it here. Someone told me that raise this board. One last bit. And this bit here, the product of j minus 1 matrix exponent, so I will call f j minus 1. So now, sorry? Yep, you did it. Well, so Feynman has it in his paper in 51. So I'll give you a reference for evaluating these things in general, which it's a good paper, but that's only from 67. So what I notice now is if we want to differentiate this with respect to CKJ, I can add an extra parameter, epsilon, and use some Feynman tricks to, or maybe someone else's tricks, to evaluate my derivative. So as I add an extra parameter to CKJ, I have to evaluate the derivative at epsilon equals 0. Oh, I should have said that this bit I'm calling DKJ. So all I really, is that clear to everyone? I'm not sure if I should explain it. Oh, it really, all that it means is that if I've got a derivative of function, f of x, I may as well write that this is equal to the derivative with respect to epsilon as I evaluated that epsilon equals 0 as I add a small piece to my x. So now we can use this identity. That this object, or this derivative, is equal to an integral. So far it seems that things are only getting worse. And I promised a reference, that's Wilcott's Journal of Mathematical Physics, and that was from 67. So now, as you can see, this x here, I'm free to chain the norm of this x, because I can pick my delta t, which should have an index j. So I can pick something small, so that, you know, this term would effectively become close to the identity, and all I would have here is y. But if I go and carry out the integration in terms of alpha, or in power series of alpha, I will find that this is equal to a set of, or a sum of nested commutators. And you will see that even if I don't pick delta t small enough, that I would only be okay to use y as an approximation to this interval. There will always be a finite number of these commutators that I have to add up to get a good approximation of this interval. So usually we pick delta t such that the norm of x is much smaller than 1. So we're almost there. All that I need to do now is substitute in the definitions of x and y to get the derivative dkz j. Sure. Oh, so your favorite operator norm. I would pick the infinity norm, so you know, the maximum element of your matrix. Any norms, okay. No, you know, most norms are, so there are relationships within norms, so you can really pick your favorite norm there. Okay, I will skip one line, so it will save me 2 minutes of writing, and I will say that you can see that a derivative of u of capital T with respect to ck j is equal to gj. Now, the set of commutator, or the sum of commutators that I will get from there. I substitute everything in. So I will only put that in the first two. You can keep on going. Interestingly, you can actually do this integral exactly if you allow yourself to exponentiate. By exactly, I mean exactly with respect to numerical accuracy of your computer. But you don't have to approximate by a finite sum. You can actually find an exponential in on a 2D dimensional, so yeah, it would be a matrix exponential 2D dimensional matrix, which in some cases is feasible. In some cases, you don't really want to make this exponential. Right, and got the FJ. Okay, so now we've found the derivative, we can substitute it in here. We're good to go. We know what's the derivative with respect to every single control that we have. And now we just do simple gradient. The descent. So the algorithm becomes make some initial guess for your control field. We often use just completely random controls, or we try find some like random smooth functions that we feed in as the initial guess. Of course, you will see it's a gradient descent algorithm, so it only converges to the local minimum, well, the local maximum that's near your initial guess. But for many problems, we do find good solutions starting with almost any initial guess. So the control landscape is quite favorable. Of course, that's problem specific. So you calculate FJ and GJ, then you evaluate all capital M times capital N derivatives of your target function of fidelity. And then you update your control field. So you go in, so this particular algorithm would say is a steepest descent algorithm. So you just go in the direction of the gradient. And I define some parameter epsilon. Maybe I'm going to use a different parameter. What's a good parameter? Delta. That is your step size along the derivative. So we don't have this promise there. And yes, it can get stuck. So typically it depends on how, it depends a lot on what are the particular control Hamiltonians, do you have a drift there? In some cases it's easier, in some cases it's harder to find solutions. But There's infinitely many solutions that satisfy this. It's not like you have to find one. And usually we do manage to find one. But it may so happen that it's very, very difficult. So there's an extra step here where I verify that my CIJs satisfy all the constraints. So if my derivative has pushed their values above some maximum value that they can take, I just clip them. And then I go back to step two and I iterate. Unless I've hit some kind of threshold value that I've set for phi. So of course, you will never hit one, but since the control landscape, even if you were hitting a peak or a maximum, then it gets flatter and flatter as you approach a local optimum. So it becomes increasingly harder to improve your fire, but you set some thresholds. Okay. So now. Right. So then if you had logical qubits, or there was there were parts of the Hilbert space that you could do an arbitrary unitary on, then you would have to define your target function accordingly so that it would only include these bits. So yeah, then this wouldn't work. This norm only really ex or it doesn't it's insensitive to the overall phase of the unitary, so it does get rid of that. So if you're asking for an X gate, you may well get I X, and it's still valid gate according to this cost function. Okay, so if you were going to include noise, so I'm going to show you an example. So in the example that I use here, I did put in noise. Then all you do is you consider different realizations of that noise. So maybe I should write down. So my Hamiltonian. So in the example that I'm using, I say that I've got a single qubit Hamiltonian, I've got some delta omega, and I've got some gamma, which multiplies my control field values. And I say that delta omega and gamma can take different values as we perform different experiments. So delta omega here, I say that it takes values in the range of minus 0.25 to 0.25. And gamma takes values. Gamma is just the sort of scalar that multiplies your control amplitudes, your control strength. I should say, just to put it into perspective, that I say that my control fields take values between minus one and one. So, and I want my target unitary, which I take to be an X gate, to be generated whichever value I pick for this delta omega and gamma from this range. So I have an ensemble of different delta omegas and gammas, and I want my target gate to be the same X gate for whichever one of these. So what I do is I pick a set of I put it on a grid, the delta, omega, and gamma values. So this would be delta, omega, and gamma. And I evaluate the same cost function for every point here on the grid, and I should give. So you have to be careful in choosing the number of points that you pick for this ensemble of delta, omegas, and gammas, so that you would be sure that in between these values, you also, so you know, you pick a finite number of these cost functions, and you want to make sure that this finite set satisfies the condition of being equal, the finite unitary being equal to my target gate. But you also want to make sure that any value in between will do that. So you have to make the grid fine enough. So here I used 231 points in total. So that was the discretization that I used for delta omega. So that's 231 points. And I simply linearize my cost function, so it's a uniform I put a uniform distribution, so every point that I specify here will get an equal weight. So I would also have to tell you that the sequence length that I picked was about 33 pi pulse lengths. Which is, David showed you a sequence last time, which was 2 pi long. I'm going to put it down on the board as well. So this is 15 times longer. But you will see how does it compare in its performance. I pick 100 equal time steps. And I run this algorithm. I run it for, I think I did four hours. And you'll see the results. So I will compare the sequence with respect to the solution that I find to the sequence that David introduced last time. Which was this composite rotation. Is it on yet? And to that was a Y gate, but it doesn't matter, it's symmetric. That consisted of a rotation around X, which was pi half, and then there was another pi half in the end. That's time axis. We need another color. So you do a pi pulse for Y in the middle. What's wrong with that? We on? Oh, there it is. Okay. So I plot the fidelities of how successfully I managed to flip my spin from upstate to downstate. So if I do just a pi pulse, so the naive pi pulse, then you can see what I plotted here is the fidelity plot. And on this axis, I have the gamma values. So they range from half to one and a half. This axis, I've got the delta omega values. And Z axis is fidelity. So you can see that if gamma is one and delta omega is zero, then my fidelity is one, and then it drops off as I move away. I've got another slightly better plot for that as well. So now here is the compensated plot. No, compensated sequence that is over there. So for this guy, well, it's hard, maybe not the easiest to see here. But you can see that this top part of the fidelity plot is a bit flatter. So you get closer to fidelity one for wider range of delta omegas and gammas. Now, the pulse that I found using this gradient descent algorithm, I think it's fair to say that it's hard to have an intuitive understanding of it, because that's how it looks. So one of the colors being the X control and the other one being the Y control. But you can see that the fidelities that it produces has got a clear plateau here. I wanted to, I asked for a pulse that worked, that gave, you know, fidelities close to one for a range of 0.25, no, why is this? Anyway, so for a range of delta omegas from minus 0.25 to 0.25, and range of gammas from 0.75 to 1.25. You can see it works a lot better. And here's here I plot cross sections of that, of these fidelity plots. So the blue one is the one that I found with the grape algorithm. So you can see for the range, so this is gamma, and I pick some delta omegas to take a cross section of my fidelity plot. This is the compensated pulse. This is just the straight up pi pulse. So the compensated guy is that guy. Yeah. So it consists of three different rotations. And as I step off that delta omega equals zero value, maybe I'm going to 0.2, then you can see that the blue curve still stays at one, while the hard pulse and the compensated pulse will reduce my fidelity. And the way it works is it's quite cool. So what happens is that for each different gamma and delta omega value, the unitary trajectory will be different, of course. You know, you start off from, so you're on the Bloch sphere, your state starts off at being the said eigenstate, or the upstate. And now here I've plotted the trajectories for two different members of the delta omega gamma ensemble. So one of them is delta omega and gamma equal to zero. And one of them is, I think it's the corner of my region of interest. And you're not meant to infer anything else from this plot than, you know, you make some really complicated path on the Bloch sphere. Your state gets spun around maybe 15 times here. But you, for both values, you end up at the same place, or roughly the same place. Yeah, exactly.
So this method is robust against little changes in delta, mega, and gamma, but it seems at first glance that this pulse you have to apply is so complicated that if you screw up somewhere in the middle, then you're going to end up completely off. Is that an experimental problem with the data?
So, yes, it is. So for a real experimental protocol, you would probably impose, so you would try to impose some kind of smoothing condition for your pulse. For this given error model that, your apparatus will only scale the amplitude and delta omega, it's a fine thing to do. Of course, it's not a perfect error model for each experimental setup. If you've got time-dependent noise, then you can also tackle that. If time-independent noise is nice because mathematically, at least, you can always find these solutions that would act over a wide range of parameters. Whereas time-dependent noise, typically there's no, well, you can't do it.
Are we able to actually implement these pulses in the lab?
So in this particular pulse I wouldn't try, but pulses that come out from this algorithm, us having imposed some kind of smoothing conditions, we use every day. Yeah. We use them all the time. The pulses that, so Ian showed you his Rabi experiment, there, even there, he may have used great pulses. Because what happens in his experiment is next to his NV, he has got the nitrogen nucleus, and nitrogen is spin one particle. So it can take a free spin value, so it gives an effective magnetic field to the electron. So you have to basically optimize your control for each one of these values.
Three values
Yes and no. The trouble there is that the free values are separated by quite some distance. So here I've got the nice continuum. So that if they were closer to one another, and closeness I'm typically measuring my control strength, so the maximum control field value. But
But if they're far enough away, you know the distance.
Yeah, the trouble is, as you can see here, we're not just going around the Bloch sphere in circles. We're doing something much more horrible. Every corner here is, we're turning, we're changing the direction of a control. So, but there are ways of dealing with it, yeah. Okay. So, number, you mean the discretization steps? So the discretization steps, you pick a number large enough so that you would start seeing results. So the gradient descent algorithm typically doesn't work if you pick a very small number of discrete steps. So usually we pick something like at least 100. Now the length, what you do is you try to make your, as I said, you try to make your gates as short as possible. So you start from shorter initial guesses, you see whether it works, and then you make them longer and longer to once you get the solution. Here, if I didn't do that, this is actually really long for that solution. That's the typical procedure. So, okay, thanks.